All right, let's head over to the Zoom line where we've got Mr. Joe Sinnott on the line with us with Winning Partners executive coaching firm. He also does the Energy Detox podcast, who just reached their 100th milestone episode. So we'll talk about that a little later in the program. We're going to talk about the new energy that's happening throughout the energy industry. But first, Mr. Joe Sinnott of Pennsylvania, how are you doing today on this post-election day? Where are we? Just a couple days removed here from the election. So we're recording this on a Thursday morning, and the election was Tuesday night, I guess. So how are you doing today on the day and a half after?
Well, I probably speak for most Pennsylvanians when I say that I'm happy not to have about 20 text messages a day and phone calls and mailbox half filled with flyers, Jason. So on that metric alone, I'm doing great.
Now, Pennsylvania was one of those swing states, weren't they? And they're kind of a different animal because a lot of people consider Pennsylvania to be a liberal state. But when you take a look at the steel industry, the coal industry, the oil and gas industry, a lot of the industry is traditionally more on the conservative side, but when you take a look at some of the elected officials, they tend to be more of the Democrat side. What's his name? Fetterman or something, who had the dress code incident and that sort of thing. But talk to me a little bit about just the political landscape, you know, kind of the 101 for dummies in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's a loaded question there, but let me answer with an anecdote, Jason, because actually I just had this conversation last night, and I was retelling a question that I had asked of a CEO who had moved here from California. And I asked him, I said, hey, you know, he was here about a year, I think, at the time. And I said, well, what's your impression of this area? You know, what are you surprised by? And the thing he said was he was surprised by how really balanced it was from a political standpoint, not just in terms of the numbers of the state. Again, as you said, we are not just probably a swing state, but the swing state of all swing states. But basically how, you know, especially here in southwestern Pennsylvania, you know, you have the red and the blue, but you're actually able to get stuff done. You're not living on the extremes. So when it comes to business and innovation and working together, he was amazed that you really just, you know, how much better it is when you're not living in maybe a California or even, you know, maybe a deeper red state. So I don't know if that answers your question, Jason, but in terms of, especially here, I think, you know, in Western Pennsylvania, we really do have that mix. And I think quite frankly, we leverage that. We take full advantage of it. So it's a great example of trying to leverage our strengths. Now, again, do you have extremes? Yeah, of course. But again, it's a nice balance we have, which I think helps us take full advantage of, you know, some of the other natural resources we have here, obviously, you know, looking at this through the lens of the energy industry.
I think a lot of people take for granted the local politics when it comes to national politics. Like, a lot of people like to pay attention to the national politics as far as vocally. They might pay attention to the local politics and a number of different things. But when you go ask most people about their local politicians, all their local politicians are honest. It's only the national ones that are crooks. That's the way most people kind of operate and behave in a number of different things. What's so interesting about certain pockets of the United States, and I'll never forget this, but I was living in Southern California because the local news was like the national news. Like, most of the national news came out of Southern California. So it was very bizarre to be coming from Fargo, North Dakota, you know, where tonight's news is the Johnson family needs their lawn watered. You know, that kind of small town news versus, you know, the murderer lived a block and a half from where you're currently living type of a thing. In your part of the area, man, that's like ground zero for natural gas national news. And every now and then, Tom Shepstone comes on the program, and he lives like on the border of New York and Pennsylvania. So it's really interesting because he gets both sides of it from, you know, the different local councils. You're over on the east side of the state. I'm sorry, the west side of the state by Pittsburgh, where a lot more of the moving and shaking is versus the, I mean, you've got some activity over there, but not quite like maybe over on the eastern side, or maybe you do. But just talk to me a little bit about the local politics, because a lot of people hear your local politics nationally, Joe, if that makes sense.
Well, I think it makes sense if you're talking about the fact that, you know, what we do here from an energy standpoint, you know, I think one impacts the nation.
Yeah,
as a
let
whole.
Me rephrase it a little bit. Let me just kind of rephrase it a little bit, because, like, you know, New York is pretty much ground zero for the natural gas ban, really, when you take a look at, you know, trying to construct, you know, different legislation when it comes to ways to ban natural gas. Most of it's coming from New York. Some is coming from California, but most is coming from New York. Pennsylvania, I mean, Susquehanna County, isn't it number one in the nation for natural gas harvesting? And then you've got these major energy companies out there that basically feed most of the economy and employ a lot of different people through their supply chain and a variety of different things. The question is more about just navigating some of the just polarization when it comes to the politics there, because your local politics, when it comes to like natural gas, that's like global politics. It's like energy politics. It's like national news when it comes to natural gas and things like that. So just trying to paint a little bit of a prominence and a little bit of an importance of how, you know, kind of your local news really becomes a lot of people's national news. And I did a pretty poor job of that, but I think maybe we got up to speed now a little bit, kind of, you know, hopefully. But talk to me a little bit about that, about the dynamic of New York, Pennsylvania, even throwing Ohio in there too, because they're kind of the wild card that can go either way any day of the week, it seems.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, let's start with Ohio. So you just, I guess, finish there. I think, you know, Ohio is a good example of a state that I think is increasingly recognizing its potential from an energy standpoint. You know, it's there, obviously, you know, the Utica, the liquids rich zone there, and everything that that, you know, can and should be. You know, I think Ohio is a good example of, you know, a state that says, hey, look, we have something here, and they're working through the process of trying to, you know, take full advantage of it. Pennsylvania, I think we're, you know, clearly we're there. I think anybody objectively would say, wow, you know, clearly Pennsylvania, you've been able to run with this gift, if you will, of the Marcellus. You know, how did you do that? How did you become the center of the natural gas universe? Yes, Pennsylvania is still second in terms of natural gas production to Texas, but, you know, how do you make that happen? And I think in large part, Jason, it's because so many of those local communities, the local politicians that you mentioned just a couple minutes ago, you know, they recognize the benefits for everybody that they serve. They recognize the huge impacts that the natural gas industry can have at that local level, and then they become advocates. And then they, you know, form relationships with the operators in this part of the world. And it truly creates these win-win scenarios. Whereas I think what, you know, where we have, you know, these lose-lose scenarios are the people who aren't connected to the operations. They don't understand the local, the layout, the playing field, the people who are impacted. And of course, then what happens? I mean, this happens in organizations as well. You start making decisions without understanding, you know, what actually goes on in these communities, Jason. And it's in those instances. And again, I mean, you could still be a local person here who is somewhat ignorant to what our industry does, but by and large, our industry goes out of its way to educate people, to answer questions. And so if somebody's ignorant, it's again, maybe that's not the right word to use, but very often it's because they're willfully ignorant. You know, they don't want to truly understand how the industry works and, you know, what the actual scientific processes are. And if you couple, you know, local ignorance with sort of this, you know, outsider narrative that might be again, just dead set against fossil fuel development of any sort. That's when you can get some holdups, if you will, in terms of, you know, local government officials who are barriers to development, which again, hurt. I mean, it is truly a lose-lose at that point, because their local constituents don't benefit. You know, the wider, you know, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania doesn't benefit. And quite frankly, the nation, you know, if we start to chip away at our ability to produce natural gas, doesn't benefit. So again, I think we're kind of dancing around a couple different things here. I don't know if I really am answering your question, but I will say that is what I see, right? It's, you know, how do you break through that marriage of sort of global ignorance and local ignorance that allows these barriers to be put up that are just completely counterproductive to, you know, playing to our strengths.
One of the things I've mentioned in the past that I thought the industry should and could do a better job of is sharing their story and telling their story. And that's one of the things that the Crude Life brand has done a very good job of for the last decade plus, is telling people's story and sharing the industry's story. And we do continue to grow because of that. But when I take a look at the industry itself, I think they got a little stuck on facts, Joe, because when the Greta Thunberg movement came, that narrative really just told a story. They told a story of fear. They told a story of the end of the world. And it's you know, just a modern day version of Chicken Little. And Chicken Little told a story. Nostradamus and the other people who stand up on the rocks on the corner telling their doomsday story, it's a story, and it can captivate. And a lot of people are drawn to that type of rhetoric and that type of story. The industry combated mostly with facts. And we're finding out now that the stories are trumping facts. It's a weird time. It's a weird world. Mm-hmm. But you are involved with executive coaching. So most of what you do is, you know, helping people tell their story, helping people share their management style, share their coach, you know, share their mission statement, if you will, through their people. Talk to me a little bit about how sharing your story, do you think that's an important thing for people to do, whether it's from your perspective, from a coaching side, like we need to get out and share our professionalism story, our executive story, or the way I phrased it from an industry standpoint, that when the environmental movement happened, it was more of a storytelling strategy, and the industry seemed to combat a little bit with a fact sharing strategy that didn't seem to work as well as the storytelling strategy goes, Joe.
Yeah, I think you're spot on in several different ways, Jason. One, and I'll hit on, you know, maybe we'll even connect this back to some of the election related conversations. But one, hearing you talk made me think of individuals, even if they're not executives or C-suiteers, you know, individuals, especially a lot of technically minded people who, again, they jump into numbers, they jump into facts. And don't get me wrong, again, as an engineer, I know that you need to support your claims with facts and data and sound conclusions and all of that. But it needs to start with a story. And again, it's amazing how often that's missed. And when I work with people on their communications, whether it's verbal, emails, presentations, again, they struggle sometimes to answer that question of, well, so what? You know, so what? People are, especially if people are already inundated with a bunch of data and numbers and facts and figures, you know, sometimes you do need to dumb it down and say, here's the story. To your point, Jason. Yes, here's the story. And if you want all the support, we got that too. But here's the bottom line. And it's amazing how easy it is for people to spend a lot of time, energy, money, again, leading with facts when, you know, the facts should support and the numbers should support the story. So I agree 100% on that. The second thing I was thinking of hearing you talk is, again, coming back to politics and elections and, you know, what are the things that can move the needle? And what is the, you know, the infamous question, I think it was, you know, from Ronald Reagan, what, was it 1980? Well, you know, are you better off? The one thing you need to ask, right, is, you know, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Well, again, asking somebody that question is going to generate far more movement and impact than hitting that person with a bunch of statistics and percentages and, you know, a billion here or 3% here or the cost of eggs here. Yeah, those things are good, but you know, you need to boil it down to something that says, hey, are you better off or not? And closing the loop, again, thinking about the energy industry, it's very similar, Jason. You know, I think finally the industry is getting to the point where it becomes very simple, which is, hey, modern existence is possible because of what fossil fuels have done. That doesn't mean that, again, fossil fuels will be the answer, you know, 100 years from now or 200 years from now. The point is that right now we are better off than we would have been if we were living, you know, 150 years ago. And we owe that to fossil fuels. That is a very simple message. Do you want to be better or not? Hitting them with job numbers and economic impact and, the cost of goods being lower than they would have been otherwise, or the cost of energy being lower than it would otherwise. Again, all tremendous things, but the vast majority of people who are busy and distracted, or again, you know, think back on the election, you know, getting 20 text messages a day, you know, they need a simple thing that they can latch onto. And that is, look, we are better, we are healthier, we are more prosperous than we would have been without this industry. So touching on a couple different things, Jason, but I think you're spot on in your assessment that a story is an important piece if you're trying to, you know, change the hearts and minds and of your constituents and get them to act or think in some particular way.
You know, one of the stories that never makes it in the history books or the Hollywood script writers meetings and et cetera, is your Steady Eddie, you know, your seventh batter, sixth batter in your lineup, you know, your goal, you know, the guy that is probably the most reliable, not your most talented, not your best salesman, not your best power hitter, but he shows up every day. He understands exactly what the mission is. He's not detrimental to the people around him, but he's maybe not very inspiring either. He just shows up, does his deal. He's a big net positive at the end of the day, but he's not talked about. He's not, and he or she, listen to me being all masochist. I didn't learn nothing at the seminars last year, Joe. I didn't learn one thing about changing my language. Holy cow.
No, see, what I'm hearing in that, Jason, is that it's the women who are actually inspiring and, you know, they're out there and they're the ones that people are talking about. So I would say that subconsciously you're just saying that, you know, it's the men that, you know, fall into this category. That would be one positive way to interpret your choice of words there.
I'm going to go with yours over my lazy ways. Yes. Thank you very much. As I get a little older, it is different though, when you've been doing something a certain way your whole life. That was kind of the accepted way. And then all of a sudden you got to just change on a dime. And it does take some time, even for those that are willingly, you know, conscious of their, I always tell people that every day I wake up and I try to be a better person than I was the day before. And there's a lot of spiritual reasons behind that, but there's also a lot of professional reasons behind that. Professional self-betterment, I believe, should be everybody's goal every single day. And that's really what we're talking about here, is that Steady Eddie person that doesn't rock the boat, but is probably the strongest piston in the engine, Joe. And you know who I'm talking about. Like you said, that sixth or seventh batter in your lineup, they don't get any headlines. You know, they might not even get the bonuses or even the annual raises, Joe, but they seem to always be there. They always seem to be the steady, most trusted, reliable person. I wanted to bring that up because that's an individual who sometimes leaves when they shouldn't because they're not recognized. That's an individual who can get burned out because they do not get the annual bonus, where maybe the person who did less work than them got the annual bonus. Let's spend a moment or two talking about the kind of the pros and the cons a little bit. It's a kind of a pop quiz, I know, but I believe you know that personality I'm talking about, you know, and in football, it's probably, I'm sure, a left tackle. It's probably a right tackle, you know, that type of thing. But talk to me a little bit about that, because we've got so many changes happening, whether it's Expand Energy or it's one of these other oil companies that have bought somebody else out. A lot of times those MVP type people can fall through the cracks because they're not going to all the social events, or they're not showing up when they need to. They're just doing their job. They're at home with their family when they're not at work, et cetera, et cetera. So how can somebody identify that? And what should somebody do to kind of keep an eye on those types of individuals?
Well, the easy answer is that you approach, one way to approach them is the same way you should approach anybody, even the, you know, the rising stars or the ones that are, again, more stand out more, maybe more obvious. And that is, Jason, to understand what their end goal is so that you can reverse engineer a set of expectations that are then, you know, consistent with what their end goals are. What happens, unfortunately, for some of the, you know, the folks that you're describing, right? You know, maybe they're quieter, they put their head down, they do their job, they're critical to the success of a company. But again, they're not out there doing the same things, or they're not, you know, maybe promoting themselves in a way that others are. What happens in those situations, Jason, and I see this all the time, is that, you know, they're being measured, formally or informally, you know, against a set of metrics that really don't make sense. And the longer that goes on, and especially as, you know, managers come and go, and maybe advocates for those individuals who really appreciate what they do, you know, as they come and go, you know, to the extent there's even a framework that can measure how impactful that person is, you know, that framework is ignored, right? You know, people have come up with their own sets of metrics and say, well, this person, you know, they're not really as valuable because they're, you know, they're maybe not as connected to the rest of the organization, or this person is, you know, probably not as, they must not be as valuable because, you know, I don't see much enthusiasm, or they're not going above and beyond. And again, while all of those things, you know, you might say would be beneficial for the person and for the company, that's not always the case. So taking that time up front, Jason, to understand what that person, you know, what's actually going to get that person excited and enthusiastic, and or what currently gets that person excited and enthusiastic, that is a step that is missed far too often. Because once you have that data, Jason, it becomes way easy to say, all right, cool. Like, you know, this person's knocking out of the park as, again, like you said, you know, somebody just batting, you know, sixth or seventh in the lineup. And like, how do we keep this going? What else can we do to support him or her? But again, it starts with that sort of that first question to ascertain what the end goal is, Jason. So anyway, I'll pause there. There's some other thoughts I have on that, but.
Well, no, that's okay, that's because, you know, one of the things I wanted to bring up is, you know, with the change in administrations, the change in energy companies, the change in executives, the change in workplaces, you have these different, you have these different puzzle pieces, these professional puzzle pieces, if you will, that you really need to put together whatever it is the puzzle you're putting together. Right. Because in some instances that they need this type of personality to work better in this area. They need this type of person to work over in this area. That's just how it goes. Just like in football, just like in baseball, just like in professional, in the professional office. So that's what all these Myers-Briggs testing are for. And there's industries based on that. So on the flip side of what we were talking about, basically what we were talking about, Joe, is the good old fashioned worker bee, you know, the worker bee that just puts his head down and wants to be judged on his work. And we're not quite there yet totally, because you do have the hype person or the faux entrepreneur, the fake entrepreneur, and they really need to rely on the worker bee, but they haven't really understood the way life works yet. And I had a podcasting consulting meeting this morning that we'll talk about in just a second. They had a real big eye opener in the realities of, you know, workers, how many staff members you need for a certain amount of different things. And ideas are great. And we can get ideas off the internet, and we could even have ChatGPT do a certain amount of things. But at the end of the day, you do need somebody out there working on the rig. You do need somebody in the office running some meetings. You do need actual worker bees to go along with your grasshopper executives, if you will. How about that hype person? How about that person that oversells? Because that is a hard thing to navigate in today's world. You want to believe everybody at their word. People, when they say things, they probably want to believe what they're saying is true, that they'll get there. They're not there, but the language they use says differently. And that's, to me, where the devil lies in the detail. If you're an executive, you need to pay attention to somebody's language so precisely and hold them accountable for that language that they themselves used, because that takes care of a lot of problems in the short and long term. That's kind of how I look at things. It doesn't always work out that way, but in a perfect world, Joe, how do you navigate that? You know, that hype employee that, everything's bigger than 10 Super Bowls type of a thing. And you're in a professional setting. You want to believe people for what they say in a professional setting. You don't want to believe that they would add marketing and exaggerations to certain things, but that's kind of the culture nowadays. There's a little bit of a culture clash happening with an older generation of the IBM generation that, you know, you underpromise. In today's generation, there's almost a little overpromising going on. So talk to me about that a little bit, about that culture clash and how to navigate that. Because, man, those are some tough waters. I still think it's in the language, but that's not everybody can really focus on that.
Yeah, well, I guess starting with the hype employee, as you put it, you know, when you have somebody like that, you start with the fact that, hey, being a hype employee, if you will, whatever that all that entails. But again, if you're somebody who can sell, and, you know, has typically high energy and isn't afraid to go and say things to other people, again, we could, you know, probably start painting a picture of what that person looks like. The key is to start with the fact that all of those things can absolutely be strengths, right, Jason? It's not this black or white. Well, you know, this person is a cultural fit or this person isn't. It's no, this person has some strengths that we can leverage. Let's start there. What are those? And then after starting there, then you talk about the risks, right? The risks to, hey, when you have somebody that can amplify a message, if he or she is using, you know, language that is inappropriate. I don't mean that from a cursing standpoint or offensive standpoint, but, you know, not choosing the right words. Well, again, well, that they're amplifying that. And what I find is, Jason, if you start by acknowledging that hype person, it is a strength, even if it's being misused or whatever. If you start with that premise, then that individual and most people around that individual are going to be far more receptive to then saying, okay, how are we misapplying this strength? What are the risks associated with, or maybe I'll put it this way, you know, what are the things that could reduce the impact of that person's strength? Again, it's a nice, you know, very positive workflow, Jason. But again, it starts with the premise that, maybe this person isn't just a, you know, it's not some black or white, is a cultural fit or isn't a cultural fit. It's how do you make sure that the pieces fit into our culture, and the pieces that don't are reframed as something that are maybe detracting from that person's strengths, if that makes sense.
That's a great that's a great accountability kind of reversal, if you will, because what I'm hearing is that if you're the executive doing the hiring or doing the, you know, the reshuffling after, you know, a merger of trying to figure out where people go and who stays and who doesn't and et cetera, and if you are trying to figure out, okay, is this person a worker bee? Does this person have strengths here, et cetera, maybe the question is more of how difficult is it to, number one, identify somebody who could be relocated into a different department? Because that, I think, is becoming more and more common. When I talk to anybody under the age of 35, Joe, it's not uncommon for them to have 7 to 10 jobs. Like, my generation, we grew up with the more jobs on your resume is a negative. Today's world, that's not an issue. And maybe that needs to be looked at a little bit more from executive standpoints, that not only do talents and skills change a little bit, but interests do too, because if the employee is of value to your organization, and maybe they need to move from HR to sales for a couple of years, or move from sales to HR or something like that. Boy, that would be quite a difference there. But do you understand what I mean a little bit, where it's an outside the box way of thinking if you're a corporation? But I think your original point is dead on, that if somebody is good at hyping or overselling themselves, boy, that's a perfect fit for sales. You all day long, man, but not maybe so much HR going to compliance meetings, trying to be exact with your words, if you will, you know what I mean? Because that might get you more in trouble, having a little bit of exaggerated language at an HR meeting, whereas in sales, it would be fantastic because that's the environment, if you will. How difficult is that for executives to redefine an employee within their organization, if it helps the organization? Because at the end of the day, it's supposed to be win-win for everybody. But man, trying to get that whole supply chain of bureaucracy to agree on something like that would be very difficult, wouldn't it?
It can be. And I think actually hearing you talk and hearing you just say the word bureaucracy makes me think of actually a great example of what you're talking about. And that's from President Trump's first term when he came into office, because, you know, when he was on the Joe Rogan podcast there recently, you know, he was asked, all right, you know, what mistakes or regrets do you have? And he talked about, you know, really what you're talking about, I think, Jason, which is when he came in and he, you know, needed to make, you know, all of these appointments, because again, I mean, you're talking, you know, I forget how many he might make directly, but then ultimately, you know, it's thousands of appointments within an administration. And he admitted, he said, you know, I messed up, right? He said, yeah, I mean, I, you know, some of his excuses were, hey, I'm, you know, I'm not from Washington, I'm a New York guy. So he was having to take people's words for it and say, hey, no, you know, you want this person on board, you want this person advising you. And, you know, even if somebody said, hey, no, look at this person's credentials, this totally lines up, he was in a position where, well, he didn't really know, right? He didn't have a full picture. You know, I think it was probably difficult for him to articulate how this rock star, right, that's being hyped up, not even, you know, we're talking about people who can maybe hype themselves or hype something, but, you know, think about the hype that surrounds another individual. You know, if you're an executive and you're stepping into a role, or even if you've been established, if you just have this surface level narrative about an individual, well, yeah, there's a very good chance you're going to make a mistake, whether that's, again, hiring somebody on for the first time, or more as what you're talking about, Jason, which is, you know, potentially moving people to another part of the organization where they can play to their strengths. The problem that I see quite often is the people making those decisions all the way up and down the line, not just executives, right? You know, middle managers, it's the same thing. They're being fed this story about a given individual that really needs to be questioned. And again, that's what I would challenge any leader out there, any manager out there, to challenge the existing narrative or hype about individuals. And that goes both ways, right? You know, challenge, you know, the negative narratives. One of the best, smartest, most productive people that worked for me was, you know, essentially damaged goods. You know, he had already worked for the company. He had some black eyes, if you will. And, you know, and I knew about those. I had hesitation, but fortunately, you know, this was years ago. I brought him on the team, and holy cow, you know, if I could hire, you know, or needed to hire one person right now, I mean, it would be him. And, you know, I'm not saying I challenged the narrative necessarily, but maybe I got lucky that he landed on my team, but certainly, you know, I'll always go back to that anecdote and say, boy, you know, leaders again, aren't at least doing their due diligence, again, one way or the other, and asking those questions to make sure that the hype around an individual, whether it's, again, a potential member of a cabinet or just, a political appointee or somebody within a corporation, if you're not doing that due diligence, Jason, boy, you're setting yourself up for, you know, for disappointment for you and everybody that relies on you and your judgment.
redefining your narrative can be difficult at times. Sometimes in the world of social media, it can be even more difficult with that. But we'll have to talk about that at a different time, because that's a very common problem in the workplace. And, you know, for, like I said, some people there, they've got 7 jobs in 7 years. And it's almost like you have to redefine a narrative every time. But in the world of social media, you kind of are defining your own narrative by documenting what you do every day. And then, so depending on who watches it and who looks at it and who does the snapshot, that's an interesting, we got to have a whole conversation about the narrative in social media and just how social media impacts you professionally. And, you know, it can also increase a lot of things too, but there is a flip side to it as well, which a lot of people don't really talk about too much, you know, and it's a big part of your brand in today's day and age. Speaking of which, I see in social media that you're a part of some kind of Marcellus group coming up here. You're either a speaker, a sponsor, or something along those lines. Is that the conference coming up, Joe, I saw?
What you may have seen, I was, my company, sponsored an event that actually just occurred last night as we record this, and that was celebrating the 20th anniversary of Range Resources fracking the Wren's number one well. That was the first Marcellus frack here that kicked off the boom, and that was 20 years ago. And so there was an event last night put on by the Washington County Chamber of Commerce here in southwestern Pennsylvania. And I was one of several sponsors for that, a leadership sponsor. And that may have been what you've seen. I am a member of various organizations, including the Marcellus Shale Coalition, which played a big role in last night's celebratory event and conversation. But that's likely what you saw and likely what you're referring to there.
That Shale Coalition, they've got an event coming up, don't they?
Their big annual public event just finished up. That was at the
end
of September. Yeah, Shale Insight is their big annual event that the last couple of years has been in Erie, Pennsylvania.
So this deal last night, the 20-year anniversary of the first frack in the Marcellus, that's what it was?
Yeah, so 20 years ago, it was actually October, if you want to get specific. It was, I believe, October 23rd. Of 2004, and Range Resources, one of the operators in this area, they had drilled a vertical well, not targeting the Marcellus, but they drilled through the Marcellus, and they were targeting some other zones in that well. The attempts to complete those zones, I believe, were unsuccessful. And then, you know, they said, hey, you know, why don't we, you know, we know about the Marcellus. We know that there's gas in it. You know, let's go ahead and throw a slick water frack on that. So it was a vertical well. So it was just, you know, one zone there targeting the Marcellus. And, you know, they fracked that zone. They saw a bunch of gas and, you know, one thing led to another. And here we are 20 years later, you know, producing tremendous amounts of gas and providing tremendous amounts of opportunities and jobs for people. And again, like we talked about much earlier in this conversation, Jason, bettering human lives, not just here in Pennsylvania, but really throughout the country and, you know, even beyond the borders of the United States.
I bet the mid-sized communities, small communities just flourished in the last 20 years up in the Marcellus. And When I drive down to the Permian or go to the Bakken and take a look at especially the Bakken, where, I mean, I grew up in some of these, you know, towns where I can remember the dirt floors in some buildings for real, you know, type thing, tar shacks and things like that. You know, that was back in the 80s. But either way, I mean, when I think about how much the Bakken, for example, has truly progressed in terms of just road infrastructure, to having community buildings, to having working water and electricity and fiber optics and a number of different things. Has that happened out in the Marcellus in the last 20 years? Are they reinvesting in the communities out there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Company. I mean, there's, you look at these numbers, it's tough to keep track of, right? You know, the, how much is directly donated, how much is going to support broadband, in rural parts of the world, how much is going to all the communities, but it's again, just huge numbers. Certainly, billions of dollars of economic impact and, many, many millions of dollars of, basically direct donations and investments in the community, Jason. So the short answer is yes, it's absolutely happening. But I guess I'd be, again, hearing you talk, the only thing I want to point out quickly is that clearly, it's easy, you can have celebratory events and everything else, and you can talk about people being better off, these communities, as you said, Jason, being better off than they would have been if, say, in this case, the Marcellus Shale, had not been developed over the last 20 years. But one of the problems when it comes to, again, controlling that narrative or making sure that the narrative is accurate is, of course, almost maybe not leading with, but certainly being very proactive and saying, there absolutely have been trade-offs along the way, though, right? When it comes to things like, truck traffic and, anytime there's some sort of commercial activity, clearly there are trade-offs. And again, where I think sometimes companies or individuals lose the narrative is when they're afraid to talk about those trade-offs. We're talking about undeniable net positive impact on communities, on our state and beyond. But to pretend intentionally or unintentionally that, there haven't been trade-offs, is again a short-sighted approach and one that, as we've been talking about here, Jason, can very quickly cause you to lose the narrative. And again, we're talking about these big things in the public domain. Obviously, in my world, I'm working, mostly with individuals within corporations, and trying to make sure that they don't lose control of the narrative, their teams don't lose control of the narrative. So, again, all of these various things that we're talking about from a political standpoint, from an industry standpoint, I want to be clear that the same pitfalls and opportunities that exist on a much broader scale, perfectly mirror the same types of opportunities and pitfalls that individual leaders need to be aware of, if they want to be as effective as possible.
Obviously, you can't get into any specific detail, but looking at going into next year, we're going to broad brush a couple things. You speak to a lot of decision makers on a regular basis, but you also speak to a lot of, executives, middle managers, supply chain companies as well. What's the vibe like out there when it comes to some of the things happening in energy, whether it's the mergers that are happening, whether it's the change in presidency, whether it's this the public relations battles that seem to be happening within the energy companies? You've got a pulse on a certain amount of, areas when it comes to the energy economy. Are you hearing anything as far as a common theme or anything that stands out a little bit that, maybe people, executives especially, should kind of pay attention to as they sit down and sit before their board of directors and shareholders as the annual meetings kind of happen right now over the next couple of months, Joe?
Yeah, I would say a couple of things, Jason. One is that there is an overwhelming sense that, natural gas is here to stay. And again, that's not news for anybody that's paying attention. I think what that means, though, I think what executives and any leader needs to pay attention to is it's one thing to say that, hey, it's inevitable that, our industry will get to a let's say maybe healthier, perhaps more predictable state at some point in the future. At some point in the future, there's likely to be, fewer worries about the price of natural gas and, whether it's at a level that can, sustain or balance activity with, keeping prices low enough for consumers. I think it's inevitable that we'll get to the point where we have the infrastructure that's necessary to provide this natural gas to America and beyond, because it makes sense, Jason. Again, everybody's aware of the rise in AI and power demand and all of those things that are going to necessitate the really increased development of natural gas. That's all a given. My message that I happily share with anybody is you need to be the company that doesn't just give the impression that you're just, you're in some sort of holding pattern, that we're just, you know, we're just waiting for things to shift a little bit, where we don't even have to be tempted to think about mergers and acquisitions, where we don't even have to be tempted to think about layoffs, where we don't have to be tempted to, sit one of our service companies for an extended period of time. The mistake I see is there's so many leaders, and again, it's natural, that are just trying to make it to another year and kind of kick the can down the road. And there is nothing more soul-sucking and demoralizing than a leader who just keeps saying, hold on and wait. Just keep doing what you're doing. Don't worry. So the antidote to that, Jason, is asking, all right, how can you actually drum up enthusiasm? How do you take full advantage of the cyclical nature of our industry that has, been cyclical for 160 years? How do you actually say, hey, we're going to lean into the fact that gas prices are low. We're going to lean into the fact that we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And we're going to take decisive action now to do that. And then again, we know that down the road, at some point, prices will go up to a more sustainable level. But here's what we can do right now. That type of tone, Jason, that breeds enthusiasm and an uptick in morale, that is something that unfortunately is not as common as I think it could be and should be, quite frankly. So if that makes sense, Jason, that kind of wraps up sort of my sense of things. And again, it gives a bit of a tip on how you have a chance as a company, or at least as an individual leader, to be differentiated, right? To not just feed your employees and your stakeholders, again, suppliers, customers, the same, as I said, soul-sucking, demoralizing crap that they can get from anybody else.
You got time to talk about the podcast real quick, the 100th episode you just recorded and launched on November 6th?
Sure. I mean, I suppose after, however many hours it takes to record and produce and share 100 podcast episodes, I imagine I got a couple more minutes to at least talk about that milestone there, Jason.
This week I've done two podcast consulting meetings, and somebody asked me about how much time they should budget for a podcast. And I said, if you do a half hour to an hour podcast, I would budget 5 hours. And they looked at me and I said, well, if you think about when you originally start thinking about the idea that you're going to come up with, when you actually sit down and do it, and then when you actually upload it and type in the words and troubleshoot whatever you got to troubleshoot in real time, and then you got to add on a few other things. I said, then if you come back and you want to promote the episode later, that takes time too. I said, so I just budget 5 hours per episode type of a thing. So 500 hours in, Joe, of podcasting you have. So yes, let's take a minute and talk about it.
Boy, when you put it in those terms, Jason, that's a scary thought for something that started off as, and honestly continues to be, really just a way to park ideas. This is not a revenue generating endeavor. It's a way to make sure that I'm able to share timely, fresh leadership information focused on oil and gas with, anybody that wants to consume it. Ultimately with the goal of, making sure that it's clear that, hey, if you are looking for a leadership development resource in the oil and gas industry, there is one place to turn, and it's Winning Partners / Joe Sinnott / the Energy Detox. So again, now you got me kind of thinking philosophically, wow, if that 500 hour estimate's right, that's a big investment of time, right? That's a lot of hours that could be invested elsewhere, right?
Well, and that's one of the reasons why I put it at 5 hours, was because when I actually sat down and and figured out really the time that it takes to properly do something. And radio, we used to say for every second you're on the air, it's a second of production time. And with the world of SEOs and descriptions and social media and a number of different things, it's changed considerably. But when I look at your podcast, Joe, I really like it. And I'll tell you why. Is because what you said, first of all, was that it's not a moneymaker for you. This is actually part of your marketing department, part of your branding department, part of your information and education awareness department. So really, you check a lot of boxes with this podcast. And not only that, but anybody who wants to follow you or wants to be a part of your universe, if you will, it gives updates, you know, where you're at with things and what's going on. But what I like personally about it is not only do you have a self-awareness about what your podcast is, which I honestly believe about 95% of the people do not have a self-awareness about what role their podcast plays in their business. You do. You're in a very small minority and should be commended for that. The other part that I like what you do is you allow your personality to come out. And, you know, whether it's, you know, kind of more of a, you know, this could be on television because you don't swear. You're not coming at a hard political stance, like, you know, like a Fox News program. I think it's more like dad jokes and, you know, diners, drive-ins and dives type of a feel more than anything, Joe, to be honest. That's the vibe I get from it, that, you know, you're kind of the, like I say, the dad that's going to go to a diners, drive-ins and dives with you and really enjoy the experience and pay homage to why we're there, and we're there because of oil and gas. And if, you know, we want to pay homage to the food, we can do that too, but let's not forget oil and gas. That's what I've always liked about your podcast, is it comes across in a very palatable, digestible way for the average person, but also for the hardcore oil and gas person too. But have you ever thought about, you know, who consumes your podcast?
Yeah. And the good news is I have such a small following that it's very easy to, you know, to figure out the demographics of who I'm speaking to. Actually, I mean, in all seriousness, this was years ago. You know, I remember hearing somebody say, you know, I don't even know if he was talking about a podcast or just in general, you know, if you're speaking publicly, you know, pretend you do have an audience of one, you know, and when you do that, I appreciate the feedback and the kind words there, but I think if you're treating it as, hey, you are speaking to one person, then you get some of that more sort of just natural, you know, connection with your audience. If it is indeed bigger than one person, that you're not going to get if you're trying to be something to everybody. Right. So that's why, you know, there's a million podcasts, obviously there's a million leadership podcasts, but you know, because I am focused on the people that I work with on a day-to-day basis, I'm not trying to speak to everybody, Jason. And that makes it, you know, a lot easier. So I don't remember what you said there about my audience or who I think about or if I have a feel for people, but I mean, it's based on the people that I work with. And, you know, probably one of the best compliments that I do get from the handful of people that will listen or watch is, hey, it's like you were speaking directly to me. You know, I mean, again, people will say it tongue in cheek, but it's like, you know, I can't think of any better compliment than somebody that's saying, hey, it's, you know, this was fresh, this was timely. I, you know, it, again, it's almost like you were eavesdropping on my conversations, Joe. And, you know, that's how I've approached all 100 episodes. And that's my plan for the next 100, Jason.
Well, here's what I'll tell anybody who's got a podcast, that the way that we did it with The Crude Life was very different. We were an early pioneer, one of the early followers. And I'll be honest, Joe, I'll probably hang on to The Crude Life till the day I die, because it is such a well-established podcast. And what I mean by that is, there's subscribers in a variety of different ways. They can either subscribe through whatever, iHeart or, you know, Google, YouTube now has got podcasts that, you know, picks up the RSS feed. So there's 100 different podcast platforms that people can subscribe through. But then there's also the email subscriptions. And that's what I kind of paid attention more than anything is, you know, who's actually taking a look at it. And I remember back in like 2016 when I did like a full on audit on my podcast. And the one thing I noticed was that over half of the people that subscribed to my podcast were millionaires. And I went, okay, that's a good audience. That's a really good audience. Like even if that audience, I hang on to that audience for the rest of my life, there's money to be made there. Like, I'm like, wow. Okay. So if I just keep satisfying that core group, and honestly, and for most of the things that I do with the Crude Life, I always think of, is this something a millionaire oil and gas professional, owner, small business owner, executive would want to hear? And so that's what a lot of the Crude Life goes into, because I bring it up because podcasts are easy to talk about, especially at social parties. And everybody's got an opinion on how you should do yours. They've never listened to 1 minute, but they'll tell you how you should do yours. And that was very difficult to kind of steer with the oil and gas industry. I can't tell you, Joe, how many people said I have to go down the hard political route. And we wouldn't do it. And we wouldn't do it. We tried to stay as non-political as we can. We talked a little politics today, but man, the politics we talked about was so vanilla compared to the rocky road that's out there everywhere else. I mean, we're trying to focus again on people's central cores and the 5,000 foot view, and not trying to get caught up in the minutia of finger pointing and a lot of those different things. And so that's kind of my advice to podcast people, is that look at your audience, decide if that's an audience that works for you, and then really focus on that audience. And then go back and do your audits and take a look at, has my audience changed? Is it the same group of people? And for me, it's always been kind of that same group, that my core has continued to grow more and more, because if people have made a good money in the industry and they leave, that doesn't mean they leave the information of that industry. In fact, they want to pay attention more now because there might be other opportunities. I don't know if that makes sense to you, Joe. And I just kind of rambled a little bit, but I've been doing podcast consulting sessions this week, so I think I've kind of got that hat on, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, all makes sense. And again, I think even beyond the world of podcasts, and anybody that's trying to communicate any sort of message to anybody, you know, should be running through the same basic checklists that you're kind of describing there, Jason, right? You know, do you need to go down a polarizing path, or can you take sort of the, you know, say, use an example of what you were just talking about, you know, can you take an apolitical conversation about politics, but again, you know, keep it apolitical, and then most importantly, connect it to the challenges and what's on the mind of your audience. That's it. That's, you know, that's a secret sauce, if you will, right? Is take something that's out there in the news or in sports or whatever, and you don't have to opine on, you know, good, bad, right, wrong, whatever. But what you do want to do is take that and explain to somebody why it matters. So again, how many talking heads are out there, you know, just getting into politics, right? And feeling like they're, you know, some sort of, you know, expert on the 2024 election, all these things. I mean, it's just, the airwaves obviously are saturated with all of this stuff. So what do? You say, hey, I can take a little piece of that and then connect it back to an individual and say, hey, look, here's what's relevant for you. You might not realize that connection. You might not realize those parallels, just like we were talking about what, you know, Trump will have to make appointees here as him and his transition team get ready to retake office. You know, what he is facing as the president of the United States is not that much different than any manager who needs to build or reconstruct a team. And I guess the last thing I'll say about that is, you know, you think about all the toxicity that comes with the election. You know, how refreshing is it to say, hey, look, you know, I've been subjected to all of this stuff. At least I can have one takeaway from election 2024 that is relevant to me that I can apply today in my professional or in some cases personal life, Jason? And again, that's very much what excites me and will continue to excite me about my podcast, The Energy Detox. And, you know, again, I think, you know, you share that same idea, which is once you understand who your audience is, what they're looking for, what's going to resonate with them, it just becomes far easier than trying to, you know, be something to everybody. And then in turn, many cases, you know, try to be somebody you're not.
Are you booking for 2025? Are you taking orders for executive coaching sessions? And if somebody reaches out to you, what's the kind of normal timeline on something like that? If somebody reached out and said, we want you to come in and do some executive coaching for us, we just, you know, had this merger happen, or we need a freshen up class, or whatever the case is, give yourself a little bit of a plug, but talk a little bit about some of the timelines too that people can anticipate.
Yeah, well, as far as 2025, yeah, like any business, it's a matter of, you know, honing in on my time and my availability. And you know, there's still lots of flexibility in the schedule to, you know, support companies. And again, my support, Jason, can look as simple as a, you know, couple hour engagement, or again, a much more involved, intense, you know, multiple hours per week type of thing. So I guess that's the first thing, which is, you know, being a small company and having that flexibility also means that I can target my services and, you know, the value that I bring, you know, based on that specific situation. In terms of timelines and flexibility, again, it starts by simply reaching out like anything else, whether that's an email, a message on LinkedIn, a phone call. I still love, again, as a geriatric millennial, I'm not afraid of phone calls. So, you know, I still love the random phone call, especially now that, again, we've gotten past election season. So there's a, you know, a higher likelihood that it's actually a phone call that I might wish to answer and engage with the person on the other line. So anyway,
do you find it easier? So I understand the Zoom, and I know you got to get running and that sort of thing, but this is something that, you know, as people go into their annual meetings, and, you know, you're out in Pennsylvania. So obviously anybody in the Marcellus and Utica and some of the eastern areas are going to be probably a little bit easier to book just for time reasons and cost reasons. Because when you start looking at Texas, there's probably some travel costs involved and a few other things. Is there a big difference between the Zoom coaching and actual in-person? Nothing is going to ever beat in-person, but are people still doing in-person, or are they mostly doing Zoom now? What's going on with that?
Most of my work is in person, Jason.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that, by the way.
Yeah, and again, it's a differentiator, right? You know, like say all the time, right? There's millions of coaches, but you know, in addition to being focused on oil and gas, in addition to having a technical background, in addition to, you know, having the, you know, corporate background and navigating some, you know, pretty memorable times, you know, here, especially in this part of the world. In addition to those differentiators, yeah, the fact that, you know, I prioritize meeting in person, that makes a difference. But I'll say this though, Jason, some of the most value, or the most intense value that individuals and in turn companies that are sponsoring these engagements get is from those on-demand impromptu phone calls, texts that I get from people who recognize that, hey, I got something in front of me. I got a conversation that's coming up here, or I got to give a presentation. And when they reach out to somebody they can rely on, a coach who, again, understands not just their general problems, but, you know, specifically, because I've been a part of this industry, you know, in many cases, specifically what they're trying to convey and who they're trying to convey it to, when they reach out and we can hop on just a phone call, or again, Zoom or Teams or whatever, or even if it's some asynchronous support where I'll just, you know, review what they're working on and flip them back some comments, Jason, you know, that's where the gold is. Now, it starts by building that relationship, often in person, right? Where you kind of build that trust when you're sitting down with somebody, but then to treat coaching as you would any other service that's out there, right? Any other service provider, third party who, again, in this industry, you expect to be able to pick up the phone and get some action right away and, you know, get results. Well, you know, when companies treat me as they would any other service provider. And they take advantage of that. I don't say 24/7, but it's, you know, same idea, right? On demand, reach out. If I'm available, I'll get back to you. Or if I'm available, I'll pick up the phone and we'll talk. That's where the gold is, Jason, because so many leaders all the way up to the top, it's amazing how much they slow themselves down. They don't realize it necessarily, but it's amazing how hesitant they are to, again, reach out, pick up the phone, and get a quick answer, or maybe some, you know, be able to just talk through something and get back on track in a matter of minutes, instead of letting it fester, instead of letting it sit there and weigh on them. And people who recognize that, or when they recognize that, Jason, and take full advantage of, you know, what having an executive coach can and should be. Oh, it's, again, it's valuable for them, but and I would hope it's coming through here. I mean, it's incredibly exciting for me as well. So again, maybe that gives a little bit of an insight on how I work and how I prefer to work, but coming back to the question of, you know, how to get a hold of me and how to kick things off. Again, it becomes a when you work for yourself here and you got a small business, certainly there's not going to be a lot of holdups and red tape on my end to kick off an engagement. I'll leave it at that.
Just the wife and kids. That's it. Just if they've got, you know, certain things that are deal breakers that, you know, as a, well, you know, like us, we've got a Catholic upbringing. So we've got a certain cultural family priorities, which a lot of people are very familiar with and you know, that sort of thing. But I did want to bring up too that kind of what I was hearing from you, Joe, is that it's very important to establish the trust on both sides, and there's boundaries that both individual employee and coaching need to mesh with. And once that trust and that boundaries are established, then a lot of those Zooms and phone calls and Teams, they just become tune-ups. They become the quick tune-ups needed, because we get together, we all agree on what our mutual goals are, what our mutual boundaries are, what our mutual mission is. And then after that, it's go, go, go. And that's, to me, the most effective coaching. And so I'm glad to hear that trust factor is there, because I'll tell you what, I mean, anybody can jump on a Zoom call for 20 minutes and try to sell anything nowadays. So I see more and more of these coachings popping up and that sort of thing. So I wanted to establish that as people go into their annual meetings that there's a big trust factor involved with your business. And then after that, just the availability that's there and everything along those lines. So, all right, man. Well, anything else we left out? You know, I mean, like I say, it's annual meeting time. So I always try to want to make sure that we get everybody the right information for when they sit down with those meetings, because, you know, as well as I do, Joe, so many of these annual meetings now define the whole year. And then it's just navigating what they defined over the next 10 months. And so if you're not on the table, you're not part of the conversation type of a thing. So, and you've probably been a part of a lot of those meetings, haven't you?
That is correct, Jason.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So, all right, we better give out that information one more time, Joe. If somebody needs a coach in 2025 and they want to reach out to you to get some information, whether it's your rates, whether it's your availability, whether it's, you know, your shoe size for whatever reason, you know, maybe they want to give you some nice shoes. I don't know. What's the best way to contact you?
You can head on over to wittingpartners.com. That's WITTING. Always happy to connect on LinkedIn if folks are so inclined. And hey, we talked about earlier, you know, just giving a good old fashioned phone call. So if anybody wants to call 412-444-5563, they are welcome to do so. And hey, again, in this post-election world we're living in, I might just pick up the phone.
And if you dial on a rotary phone, Joe will even give you a discount or a special gift. We haven't decided yet, because this is kind of a joke, but either way, I was thinking a phone, boy, how retro. That's as a guy who came from the print industry, I had to take my newspaper, our old man slings for a while there. So I kind of understand how the phone people are going through that now. But hey, man, I appreciate the time today, and we'll talk down the road. Okay, Joe?
Thank you very much, Jason. You take care.